Hi, it's Karen Webster for Payments.com, and I'm here today with Michael Rieblatt, the CEO and founder of Forter. Michael, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for inviting me again. Sure, we'll have a very interesting conversation.
Yes, it's always fascinating to catch up with you because, of course, Forter is in the business of chasing fraudsters away from point of sale and doing all of their malicious activities there. So that is really the focus of our conversation. And I'd like to start by putting the conversation in context. And of course, as we approach the liability shift date, October the 1st, everyone is now focused less on the physical point of sale, given the introduction of chip at the point of sale in stores, and now fraud online. So everyone talks about the fact that it will increase. Maybe you could give us your perspective on why. Why will online increase all of a sudden now because of this shift to EMV?
Well, when you look about why fraud happens, or actually who is the cause of it, the majority of it is our professional criminals. They make their living from fraudulent activities. Because of chip and PIN or whatever chip implementation in their cards, it makes it very, very hard for them to copy physical cards. If they want to keep and make their living in a criminal way, they have to move somewhere else when it will be easier for them to continue and steal money by fraud. So they all move to online. And we saw that in every market that introduced any kind of EMV regulation in the past, Europe, Australia, Canada, and so on. We see, you kind of read a lot of different reports estimating that the rise of fraudulent activity in the online world in the U.S. will be anywhere from 50% increase to 110% increase in the next 2 years.
Wow.
Following, kind of depending on how fast EMV deployment will happen.
So that suggests a couple of things. So I guess the first question I have for you is, there's always been commerce online, and yes, there has been this other point of sale environment physically for the criminals to target. But is it that online just isn't as secure? It seems like fraud online is pretty manageable today. So what's going to change?
Well, I'm not sure that fraud online is manageable today because I think a lot of people underestimate the damage that is caused to their business, and they only focus on how much money they're losing from fraudulent chargebacks, and not from everything else that they build their business around because fraud happens. I do agree that after EMV implementation, it will get worse, but I don't think that should accept today's situation as good enough to live in. I think it's far from it. When we look at the numbers of the industry numbers, and especially when we look at deeper into the numbers of customers and retailers who already worked with, we see a dramatic loss that they incurred due to fraudulent activities, mainly turning away good customers or serving their existing customers with very, very bad experience.
I see. So when you say that the industry is only focused on what they're losing in terms of chargebacks, the other piece of it is the friction that they're inserting into the system that is turning good customers away.
Yep.
So how do you help?
Well, the first thing we do is we want to shift, kind of restore the balance in the market and say, retailers should be retailers and fraud professionals should be fraud professionals, and everyone should kind of focus on what they're good at. And it eliminates kind of sometimes the internal tension of doing business activities that are riskier and then canceling them because of risk consideration. What we want to create is complete fraud-free e-commerce or fraud-free environment for the retailer. We can't eliminate fraud altogether. Criminals or cyber criminals will always be there, and they will always try to do their thing. But for the retailers, what we are creating is completely fraud-free environment for them to act in and make decisions solely on what's good for their business. By shifting all the fraud-related liabilities and damages and operations to us, essentially what we're doing all of their transactions online, giving them real-time yes-no answers. And for everything we said yes to, if anything goes wrong there, we take the hit. So we pay for it with all the fees that the networks or the acquirers may add there as well. So if we said yes, the retailer can go on and do whatever they want.
So you better be pretty darn good at detecting something that is suspicious. How do you get to be so good?
Well, we've been dealing with that for probably or various kinds of it for more than 15 years. So we all started in the Israeli military intelligence. So catching not fraudsters, but terrorists or criminal organizations moving money to weapon deals and so on. Got very, very good at tracing malicious activities or especially malicious intent of activities that look legitimate for supporting terrorism. Then we adapted it to online fraud prevention in a different company called Fraud Sciences, which was acquired by PayPal. And we, through the experience we acquired in PayPal, which is, a billion transactions a year, probably in every possible scenario, we got another level of education. And then finally, in the last 3 years, we're working on Border, and that's by far the best product for fraud prevention we've ever created. And it's kind of all built on knowing and learning how fraudsters act. Instead of common belief that if something is suspicious in a transaction, it must be fraud. And we want to restore it back to, unless you're proven guilty, you're still innocent. You're still a good buyer. You may look weird because of, the world is changing and a lot of different things happen every day. And they may look weird to someone who knows the world of yesterday, but we know that you're guilty, we'll let you through. And it's proven itself to be very, very good for our customers. But it also requires a really intimate understanding of fraudsters and their activities and their tools. So I think we kind of started talking about that the last time, of all the research we're doing in the deepest, darkest corners of the internet to learn what fraudsters are doing, how they trade information, where they buy their information. We actually learn about a lot of the data breaches and credit card theft even before they're announced, because we constantly monitor that.
So you're like undercover agents, but only in the dark, deep world of the dark web.
Yeah, well, remember, we're all military intelligence people. That's how we think. Yeah. Sometimes we feed them correct information that we know to anticipate at the other end of it and see what they do. And they respond. It's a learning process. Fraudsters adapt extremely fast. And unless you know how to adapt with them or one step ahead of them or half a step ahead of them, you will lose.
Wow.
So flexibility is way more important, I would say, than bigger walls.
So let me ask you a couple of questions, because I know that one of the things that is very unique about your approach is that you talk about understanding the fraudster. There isn't a single profile of a fraudster. There are many different types, some more dangerous than others. What do most in the payments ecosystem, and I'll focus on retailers now for a minute, what do they underestimate the most about cyber criminals and the crimes that they perpetuate? Is there something that most people miss that, because of your experience, you know for sure is dangerous?
Well, I think there are two things. First, they underestimate how easy it is for professional fraudsters, not the majority of them, but for to create a complete identity, find there's kind of a perception that if it's a domestic transaction, and if we see that the shipping address is close to the billing address and the IP is close by, then it's probably a good person. But it's so easy now to get an IP address or a proxy server really close to the location of the credit card. And they connect. When you actually buy a credit card, you can select the specific zip code you're buying the credit card from. And then you can find, let's say, a house in foreclosure in that area you can ship the goods to. Everything looks just perfect from standard fraud prevention systems, but it's all bogus. It's all criminal. So it's really easy now to create a completely fake identity with physical location and a digital footprint. And I think the second thing people tend to underestimate is how quickly fraudsters can exploit something that they found that works. So we saw several examples like this in different places of everything was fine. So the fraud levels were, let's say, acceptable rates for that particular retailer. And all of a sudden, a group of fraudsters found a way to penetrate that. And then they just attacked in several days with a large array of different identities and create a massive hit on that retailer. And then went away. They're very good at exploiting really fastly and exploiting a new way for them to get money.
they're obviously very skilled. And I think that's probably the other thing that may be a little bit underestimated. I mean, you make the point, these are professionals. This is their job. And like other professionals, they're always trying to perfect their skills and do a better job, unfortunately, at our expense. So your approach, though, is very different. You are basically saying to the retailer, you will have a fraud-free zone.
Mm-hmm.
We're taking the risk and the burden. Why wouldn't every retailer take you up on that offer? I mean, to me, that sounds like a very, if I wanted to outsource all of the complexity and get rid of it, what's holding retailers back from doing it? Why wouldn't they all do it?
I think they all should do it. And I think that with the way that we're growing, with the traction of customers that we're seeing, they will eventually do that. Still an industry that doesn't move as fast, and we're still a growing company, so we haven't talked to all the retailers. But I'm hoping that conversations like this will actually get our message across everyone. Because as you're saying, it's a complete win-win-win situation. The retailers don't have to deal with fraud and don't have to take ongoing and growing risk of anything going wrong and them losing a lot of money. But maybe as important, the customers of those retailers, so the buyers, don't have to go through very complicated, from their perspective, very cumbersome checkout processes or verification processes or limitations of what card can you use to buy, where can you ship it to, or how fast can you get it. So I think we had some of our customers run an NPS test of checking how much their buyers like what they're doing from a service perspective. And we see a huge increase of 60% every time, on average 60% every time we move in, because it gets so much easier for the buyers to buy, which drives conversion and drives general happiness. And then they recommend. I mean, think of it, every time I wanted to buy something before I moved to San Francisco, I had an Israeli card. Half the retailers wouldn't want to work with me. The others wouldn't want to allow me to ship to a hotel. So I ended up just buying at Amazon because it's very easy. There you go. You type your card. No one asks you too many questions and you get it. And now we deliver the same level of checkout service everywhere else. So we sometimes see buyers that are surprised that they actually made it. And then they tell everyone else. We have a few tweets that we've collected of people surprisingly announcing that they were able to buy something. And it shouldn't be like that. Buying should be easy.
Are there things that you can discuss? Obviously, there are a lot of insights that you have because you do put yourself in the shoes of the fraudster to understand how they think in order to anticipate where they might strike. But are there insights that you can share about where you anticipate problems now that we are going to be living in a world where the incidence of fraud online is likely to spike?
So the first thing that will happen is that people probably underestimate is there will be way more domestic fraud or domestically originated fraud than before, because there are a lot of people in the U.S. that make a living from copying cards. You would go to a gas station. It probably happens to me because I travel so much. It happens to me once every 6 months that I have to replace my card because someone copied it. Now, with the chip implementation, it will probably never happen again. But those people will just try their luck online. So previously, most of the successful attempts for online fraud were actually outside of the U.S., a lot of Eastern Europe, Africa, Southeast Asia. But now there will be more domestic attempts as well. And once again, we saw that same pattern a few years back when Western Europe implemented that, Australia and Canada. And I think we don't talk about that as much as an industry. So I think the prevalent opinion or kind of notion of there's less fraud in domestic transactions, we'll have to question that again.
And so that will make it harder to detect, right? Because that's, you make the point that it's easier for a fraudster to create an identity that looks very real. The trigger was perhaps from other geographies outside of the U.S. in this case, made it easier to detect. You're suggesting that the environment has become more complicated.
Yeah, it's actually two separate things. So first is the sophisticated criminals from outside of the U.S., it's easier for them to create a believable U.S. identity and get access to a U.S. shipping address and a U.S. IP address or server. So this is one. But second, it's actually U.S.-based people or criminals who will use their own identity, because they're not necessarily all as sophisticated as the one previously mentioned, but they are already in the U.S. They already have a domestic identity. They already have access to a domestic address. And if you look at kind of the dominant approach for fraud prevention today, it's still very rules-based. It's still very kind of common knowledge-based of, hey, well, if we will inspect and limit way more on the international transactions or on digital goods transactions or on something which happened to us in the past. So it's very interesting for us to see, as we start working with a new customer, all that they learned and all the rules in their system based on what happened to them in the last 2-3 years. And sometimes there are things in the systems that are 3 years old because, let's say, a French group attacked them 3 years ago. They handled that and the rules are still there because they have 1,000 different rules in the system. So no one remembers to check that. And of course, the biggest impact here is on the good buyers you turn away, because now no prejudiced person can buy because someone blocked him 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Or they will just get, hey, please call our call center or we sent you an email. So no more quick fulfillment because you're still waiting for the buyer to contact you.
So more domestically originated fraud is one thing you expect to see. What are some of the other insights and observations that you can share?
So I think the other things that are happening are not necessarily EMV related. I think the biggest impact of EMV, you will see a lot more attempts and a lot more domestic attempts, and you'll have to deal with it. But there are other trends that are happening that retailers have to adjust to that are just not EMV relevant, but are happening at the same time. The first is, we see a lot more desire of retailers to move to quick fulfillment. Amazon teaches everyone to try to be better, which I think as a consumer, I think it's a really great transformation of the industry. But quick fulfillment cannot be based on manual authentication or on suspecting a lot of people. Because if I expect to buy something and get it shipped by tomorrow, and then I'm flagged as suspicious and I don't get it tomorrow, I will be a very unsatisfied customer. And we see that impact on buyer satisfaction. Second thing, which is also growing in some retailers, so I think mobile transactions are getting closer to 50%, if not above that. A lot of other retailers are still far away from there, but it's definitely growing. And some of the bigger challenges mobile is, first, old tools just don't work on mobile. There are types of data that we were accustomed to collect from web transactions are just not available on mobile. There's a lot more information from mobile, but it's new and we need to adapt to it. And second, you can't ask buyers to type in so many details.
Right.
I would even challenge the question of, why do we need the billing address as part of the authentication? Have to ship it to. It's just something else we require the buyer to type in because we need to authenticate him. If we would know that this transaction or this buyer is good, we would ask them way less details, which will significantly help mobile conversion. And we're actually A/B testing that with the help of some of our customers to see the impact of every single detail in their checkout on conversion and on the risk that we're assuming. And they can do that because we assume all the risks. So if something happens, it's on us. So it's very easier for them to test new checkout and authentication methods because, worst case, nothing happened. Best case, their sales just increased by 5-10%.
So any insights from those A/B tests that you're willing to share? I mean, I agree that, authenticating the consumer is the real silver bullet here, but many, many different theories on how to do that effectively.
So actually, I know silver bullet is kind of a thing we always look for, but unfortunately in fraud prevention, there are none. Every time someone thinks they create a silver bullet, then the fraudsters will just develop silver armor and we have to move along with our, periodic table of medals. I don't remember what comes next.
But wow.
Everything changes so fast, you can't. I mean, once it was believed that device fingerprinting is the silver bullet of authentication.
Yep.
And now we see it doesn't work. It's part of the solution. You need it, but it can't rely solely on that, because it will create a lot of false positives and still a lot of false negatives. So you need to understand your business, I mean, there are no one tip I can say that will help everyone. It's kind of very, very specific on what you're doing, what the products that you're saying, how your fulfillment works, how your customer service works, and what are you trying to achieve.
You know, it's interesting because I was speaking with someone else in the industry a couple of days ago, and one of the remarks related to mobile and the point that you just made, which is there's this quest for the frictionless checkout, especially on mobile devices, because it is really difficult to type in all the information. So in the effort to make things very seamless, it's often at the expense of building in the safeguards that do protect the retailer ultimately from having that experience with a fraudster. And the smaller the retailer, the more at risk, because there aren't layers of risk and compliance people who are inserting themselves in the process and saying, hey, but what about this? The marketing and product guys are just trying to make the sale and trying to get the consumer experience to be a good one.
Well, to tie it to something I said in the beginning, I say let them. If the marketing and product people say that it's good for business, let them do that and worry about risk later. And by using something like Porter would be a great way for you to do all of this innovation, because if something happens, it's on us. As long as we work together, and we always work together with our customers and to anticipate and share our knowledge of, hey, well, this is probably what will happen once you introduce this innovation, because we've already seen it in 10, 20 different customers before. But please go and try it and know that no matter what happens, you're covered. So I think we need to enable to shift payment innovation into the hands of product and marketing and conversion people, and not just keep it at the hands of payment and risk people. I think we need more opinions there and more kind of free ways to try it.
That's actually a very good point. I mean, because you're taking the risk, why not experiment with lots of interesting ways to increase the experience? One final question, and then we'll let you get on with your day. What are some of the schemes that fraudsters have perpetrated that are sort of out of fashion? So what used to be the thing, which is now no longer a predominant way that fraudsters are wreaking havoc within the payments ecosystem?
So I think it's a learning process of fraud prevention. So probably, I don't know, 5 or so years ago on average, you would see a lot more, let's call them amateur fraudsters, who will just attempt a huge, they'll get access to tens of thousands of cards and will try to execute almost a batch transaction. So scripts were more successful in the past. Now everyone is way better equipped to dealing with that, partly because of device interpreting that I mentioned. You can't just do 1,000 different transactions from the same device. You'll get caught and stopped. So this doesn't work anymore. You have to invest more to create a believable identity, and it has to be different, and you'll probably have to create kind of switch devices or use virtual machines to do that. Part of the challenges, by the way, of virtual machines is they're kind of the opposite trends. Probably 3 or 4 years ago, virtual machines were still rarely used by legitimate people. So if you would detect that, then you know that something is off. But now almost everyone uses them for a lot of different cases and scenarios. And you can't just block every transaction that you identify as a virtual machine. Same thing goes for people are just moving more internationally. So you're traveling more often, and you would use your own network. So a proxy server that used to be a very, very bad indicator is actually a very good indicator in some cases, because you know it's a traveling businessman, or you're just working from home and connecting to your workstation. So I think there is way more business kind of legitimate innovation happening that we need to adjust our fraud prevention systems to support that and make sure we don't turn away good buyers and don't create a cumbersome process for them to buy, rather than focusing on what used to be common fraud cases that are no longer being successful or are just being used. You sometimes see through our searches on the dark web old fraudster manuals of what should you do to get away with fraud using online payments, and none of that will already work because you need to be more and more sophisticated. But it's all ongoing process.
I always love talking to you because it's a fascinating part of the business, and you talk about having skin in the game, you clearly do, and have to really be not only one step ahead, but many steps ahead of these professional cyber criminals who seem to adapt very well to whatever we happen to put out there to try to stop them. So, Michael, thank you very much for your time today and for the benefit of your insights. I look forward to catching up with you again.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure talking to you.